And it's 7 o'clock. You're listening to CFRC 101.9 FM. We're broadcasting from Carruthers Hall, Queen's University, Kingston, Ontario. And that was the sounds of
just
Robbie.
I just wanted to...
He was underneath my... He was the
that's what you wanted all the time.
The music bed.
We're experimenting.
Yeah, experimental radio.
Anyway, it's a lot of fun. And Rachel, you're spending some time with us tonight.
Sure.
And it's going to be very special for us as we sit and chat in a little bit. But I wanted to, we were having fun with that, the idea of explaining about the train track that they're talking about putting in Eastern Ontario. And, I'm thinking about it. Quebec to Montreal, they still have to go through the same thing. Montreal to Ottawa, I think they've gone through this process. They know where their line is and everything they want to do, but they've got two different provinces to deal with there.
Right, yeah.
And then now they're working on trying to figure out where to put the line in Eastern Ontario that goes from Ottawa to Peterborough to Toronto. They still have the other part of the corridor if they're going to finish it to Windsor. Not sure.
Oh, is that on the table? Okay.
That was a possibility, but we're not going to talk about that at all tonight.
So my thing is this, Doug.
Mm-hmm.
Why can't you just put them on the tracks that are there?
Well, that's
We got three tracks now.
That's an excellent question, but the high speed
train. Did you ask Alto?
It's a high speed train, and they're different weight, and they need.
Are they lighter?
They're a lot lighter. Yes,
well,
they're electric.
Oh, and electric.
Yeah.
Oh,
cool. So
probably also, how many trains are they going to be running on that thing? Like, I'm assuming
that's a good
conflicts.
Question. At first, it'll probably be two a day or something like that.
Right, depending on demand.
At first, just to get it going, and then the passenger, depending on the passenger travel on it. Mm-hmm. But if it's anything like what happened in France when they put the TGV, which is the very high speed train in France,
mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's all right. Same thing.
Why don't you go to Japan?
No, just say.
You could have went to Japan. Japan's got one.
No.
Japan was the first one.
No, they weren't. 1961 was the start.
French people copied the Japanese.
Oh, good.
It's opinion hour with Sean.
Yeah. He's going to look it up in a few minutes. But the problem...
He's going to derail your conversation.
The answer for you, Sean, is that they can't run them on the same tracks, and they cannot have interruptions. A high-speed train is a high-speed train for a certain reason. It goes from A to B with no stops. And that means there's also the problem with, they can't have people like farmers driving across their track or...
their track.
Yeah.
It's their track
That's
now.
That's right.
Yeah. I believe it's a federal program, right?
It is.
It's a Crown Corporation?
It's a Crown Corporation as opposed to the government.
And how did it suddenly become their track? Wouldn't it be our track?
No.
It's not our track.
You're paying the bill, sure.
Never mind. Not only are you paying the bill, you can't ride this thing.
Well, that's going to be
it's going to cost a fortune. Just regular train costs a fortune.
Well, yeah, but at least you can get to the train station.
Well, that's my other thing is that, okay, it's going to come from Quebec.
Mm-hmm.
Rick, that's the city, right?
Yes, Quebec
City.
Mm-hmm.
And it's going to run right down there to Ottawa. And then Peterborough? Why is Peterborough a stop?
School? I don't know.
Somebody made a decision.
That makes no sense to me.
Oh, no?
Have you been to Peterborough?
Yes. I played hockey against
them. Why didn't
it
just go right through Peterborough? That would be my guess.
I hope there are no Petertonians listening to this. I don't know what they're called there.
Again, have you been to Peterborough?
I have spent time in Peterborough. I am not arguing with you. I just, I'm sure people there would appreciate. I mean, anyone in a small town appreciates access to larger, you know.
Did they have access to a train at all?
Right now? No.
Oh, they don't have anything?
Okay, then. All right.
Anyway.
Let off the hook.
So,
well, if they don't have anything.
You know, your question.
All those people trying to get out of Peterborough. Population.
Your question is an excellent question, and the presentation that I did see.
Is it only stopping in Toronto?
Yes.
Like it doesn't go to Windsor?
Not yet. Well, that's not the plan yet, but I don't know. They haven't done. Look at the flack they're getting in Eastern Ontario, and how many people are there.
They got a lot more use to deal with.
Why don't they just go the other way? Why don't they just go the other way, like to Vancouver or BC or?
Well, maybe this is the trial.
That'll be your question, and that'll be the
question.
You should
have been there, Sean.
Yeah, I didn't know I was there. I didn't
know. Anyway, I it was informative.
For the most part, I really don't.
The best part for me was the quick. You'll hear it as I'm talking with Pierre-Yves Boivin. He is the chief communications director for the company. Did I ever get the person? And guess what? He's connected to Queens.
No way.
Yeah, you'll hear.
How?
You'll hear in a minute.
And you're like, how come we're not on a map?
So have you ever been to Peterborough?
Have you ever been to Queens?
Well, no.
Anyway, no, so we played with that too. In the interview where I started was out in the area where everybody was talking around us and everything. I tried everything I could do to kind of block out the sounds around us, but for the first couple of minutes, you're going to hear a bit of the sound. And then I was able to ask, could we have another room to work, to talk in? And it was really comfortable, except for one problem. There was no heat.
Oh, yeah.
And you know.
How long were you there?
I was fine. I had my down sweater and I had a couple of other things on. So I wasn't it wasn't a problem for me, but Pierre-Yves, he had a bit of a problem because he only had a t-shirt on.
Ooh.
Because with all the people there, it would be really warm. So I loaned him my down jacket, and he wore it the whole time.
Well, that's good.
And near the end, you'll hear what his comment was. But, I mean, he just nonstop talked, but he's the director.
This guy couldn't dress himself properly, but he's going to put together the train?
He's fine.
Where did he come from?
Well,
Quebec.
The question was, where did we come from?
Yeah.
You come from Quebec. It's like
Doug's always ambushing people, dragging them into cold rooms.
Equally as much reason.
No.
Is he even from Canada?
He's out in the back. He's out in the backwoods with us, and you know, we
Sean's
don't have heat out there.
I don't know. Okay.
Now you got to be careful. You got to be nice to him because he's also the director for the Indigenous Studies Connection.
Oh, neat. Which one?
He's going to be talking to you.
Okay. We have
the Indigenous Studies Connection.
We're whetting the appetite for the interview
for
here.
Sake.
So many questions will be answered.
And following his chat with us, we're going to hear from Twin Flames, Porch Light.
My name is Pierre-Yves Boivin. I am Chief Communication and Engagement Officer at Aalto. I am also a proud Queen's University alumnus. I graduated in 1999 from the School of Policy Studies with a Master's of Public Administration.
Well, it's great to meet you today, and you're going to show me a map. Quick talk.
This map is available online as well on our consultation platform at altotrain.ca for people to consult, and there's also an interactive map where they can put pins, including all their comments and feedback. We have already more than 5,000 comments that are online.
Oh, is that right? And they're all available for anyone to see.
They're all available for people to see. So that corridor is a zone that is under study. It is not the final alignment yet, but it's an area where our team felt that the potential for a high-speed rail service is the most interesting. But we still have a lot of work to do to establish where the exact alignment will be. We have not made that determination yet. We still have a lot of work to do on the ground, sending teams to do field surveys, but we also need to work with provincial governments, local authorities, get more data, understand better the actual situation on the ground. But it's a zone that we've put out to consultation because we want to hear from communities, from stakeholders, from citizens, their concerns. We want to hear what they think also are opportunities, where within that corridor are areas where it might be, in their opinion, and also based on their expertise, a better area to build a train, or an area where there are specific constraints that we might not know about yet, and they will tell us. So we've organized a consultation process that is trying to reach to the community in a different way. Today we're at an open house in South Frontenac for, where anybody can come, and we're organized around seven stations that we try to where in which we try to really cover all aspects of the project. But people can also reproduce this online through our virtual sessions, so live at different times during the week. During the entire consultation period, there will be 10 sessions, 5 in French, 5 in English, and we have parts of our team there to answer questions. There's also the online platform. But we've also organized roundtables with associations or groups in civil society that have specific experience in all these local areas to get their feedback, get their database, and work with them to help us find the best possible route that minimizes impact on a wide variety of criteria, such as, you know, land acquisition, indigenous activities, environmental constraints, obviously agriculture, community involvement. So we want to minimize the impact on the urban fabric as well. We're in cities. So it's a very complex job that we have to do. So this is what we're presenting today at all.
Okay. Mandate to connect seven cities, Quebec City, Trois-Rivières, Laval, Montreal, Ottawa, Peterborough, and Toronto. And we need to find an alignment to connect these seven cities that minimizes impacts on, you know, landowners, indigenous communities, the environment, agriculture, urban integration, the populations in between. We also need to factor in many technical requirements that a high-speed rail service needs. And obviously, we need to keep this affordable for the Canadian taxpayer because it's a public project. So it's not an easy task. And that is why, at Aalto, we have decided to initiate a first round of public consultation early in the process, which is what we're doing now. So that is why we have put to consultation a wide corridor that is much wider than the actual alignment easement that we will need to acquire. So the corridor is about 10 kilometers on average. It is wider in some areas, but it's a bit narrower in others. But the final right-of-way that we will need to acquire is about 60 meters wide. So the surface is going to be much, much smaller than why are we doing this then? We're doing this because we haven't completed our studies. We haven't completed our field work. We haven't consulted with municipalities, with the Government of Ontario, Government of Quebec. We haven't finalized our data gathering that would allow us to select the final alignment. This is the kind of work that we've started, that is ongoing, and that we'll keep on doing for the next months. But we felt it was important to already get initial rounds of comments, feedback, suggestions, recommendations, data to inform that analysis that is ongoing.
And so people who are listening to this and want to find out more about it, the interactive map online?
Yeah, different,
a good place?
Different options. So obviously on our website, altotrain.ca, you have access to our full consultation platform, which then reproduces all the information that you would have at an open house. So you have all the visuals, you have an interactive map where you can put pins, insert your comments. I think we're over 5,000 comments already, which reflect the points of view of people from across the corridor, and we leave them there. So people can actually see what others have thought, they can see what comments were made, they can be suggestions, they can be criticisms, really everything stays there and everything has value. They can also join one of our virtual sessions. We try to reproduce live with the presence of our experts as well, a mini open house for those of us who can not actually join the open houses. So we have 5 sessions in English, 5 sessions in French. They're held at different time of the day, different days of the week, and everything is available on our consultation platform.
So that's on the details.
Autotrain.ca.
Autotrain.
Yeah.
Okay. Because when I started looking at, I saw all these little pins, and I thought, and it did invite me to put a pin in, but I didn't know what to put into the pin. Well, no, not. So I didn't have questions or concerns that I would like to put in for each of the spots. But you're going to do this so that people can zoom in on a map on a computer, and it may be the little bridge down the road from someone where they're living, and it's a spawning route.
Exactly.
So they would let you know that.
It could be that. It could be, have you thought of this particular old right-of-way that nobody uses anymore that could be useful for you?
Are there still old right-of-ways?
Well, there are some. There are some, actually. These are all things that we need to fully analyze. You know, we're trying to be adjacent to existing corridor. And we cannot be fully adjacent all the time, but if we can, we will, because mm-hmm. it minimizes the impact.
Right.
So it could be roads, could be old roads, could be highways, power lines, existing railways,
mm-hmm.
old railways. But we also need to factor in how these infrastructure are used nowadays. And we know that some old railways have become, you know, hiking trails, valuable areas, and therefore we take all this into consideration.
Mm-hmm. What about the in Ontario, the conservation areas? There are quite a few conservation areas that go from Ottawa to Toronto in each of these corridors, and they're under flux right now. Politically, they're being changed into, I don't know what it is, 7 different conservation entities. I don't know what it is. So will you be able to get the data you need for each of the areas from them before it becomes something else?
Yeah, that's the work we need to do. And that's why, you know, having the corridor approach allows us to basically get that information before we make the final decision on the alignment. So we are in contact with municipalities, the government, a variety of other stakeholders, associations to get this information. And that's why we're hoping that some we might not have mapped are going to show up and say, hey, we exist and we have data and we'd be happy to work with you. And that's why the consultation is important.
Okay, because some of the land trusts that are in one of the corridors that you have there, Queen's University has land that they use for research, and the Nature
Conservancy of Canada.
They are involved as well. I know the one that's within one of these corridors. I haven't talked to them, and I don't know if you have, but, you know, the biological station that Queens has out at Chafee's Locks has, you know, close to 10,000 hectares of land.
So these are the kind of organizations that we want to be contacting. That's why we also organized something that is not open to the broad public, but we call them our roundtables. We've organized roundtables along the corridor at various locations. We have 36 roundtables that were organized where we invite associations from civil society that have knowledge, local experience, expertise, specific mandates. And so we've held a few of them, and obviously we might have missed some people. We usually establish the list in consultation with local authorities, but sometimes, you know, there might be people that we should have contacted. So if that's the case, people should feel free to reach out to us. And again, on autotrain.ca, it's possible to get in touch with us.
And so the information you're getting, will it be there from those places?
Correct? Yeah, definitely. And then we're also going to publish a consultation report at the end of this consultation phase in the spring. What we heard report, which will you know, basically give a sense of the comments we have. We can't obviously reproduce every single question or comment we will get, but we our intent is to give an appropriate and an accurate picture of the comments and the concerns that we received through that consultation. And that will also help us develop the project definition that we will have to file to the Impact and Assessment Agency.
I'll bet, since you're a graduate of Queen's University, you should be the spokesperson to contact the life sciences folks. The new dean is going to be really happy to see that Queen's students go off and do things and they come back to ask questions.
Well, I'd be happy to, be put in contact with them.
Okay. We'll get the information for you and you can chat with
okay.
them. On a different note completely, part of our look at is right now is what First Nations communities are being asked to be involved. And, you know, I see through the corridor there are two problems that come up. One is that the Algonquins of Ontario, they're located in Pembroke. I don't know if you've been in touch with them at all, but they aren't included in a lot of changes that are happening within the area that's been agreed to by the Government of Canada and the Province of Ontario and the Algonquins of Ontario. It's been almost 40 years that it's been going on. So have you folks like that, would you be able to see? And then in Quebec, I see there's Abenaki, the First Nations that are on the South Shore.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting you mentioned these two because, well, I'm as Chief Communication and Engagement Officer, I'm also responsible for Indigenous Relations and Consultation. That team is under my leadership. We have 40 communities that we need to consult that are potentially impacted by this project. That list was developed using the federal ATRIS. I think it's the ATRIS. It stands for Aboriginal Treaty Rights Information System, which basically is a database listing all the the claims and the rights of Indigenous communities
within the corridor.
I think in Canada, and then from that database, we've identified with other federal entities the list. The current list. I mean, the list could change over time. But the list of those 40 communities that are potentially impacted, and the Abenaki are part of it, and we are in touch with them, and the Algonquins of Ontario are part of it as well. So
some folks didn't know that, especially while they're aiming for to go to Perth for the open house or like this.
Yeah.
So, all right.
That is why we also have.
It's easier for them to understand. They can go and talk to their.
Yeah, and we have launched we've been in contact with all 40 communities. We have also started our official consultation because, as you know, we have a duty to consult as a federal crown corporation. So we have started officially our consultation on the corridor. We haven't met yet all communities, but that is in process. And then we're also working to involve Indigenous communities in the project for elements like field studies. We've developed an archaeology protocol with them as well. So there's a lot of work that we're doing to really, really involve Indigenous communities in the project. We've worked, before the project was ever announced, we've worked with them to establish meaningful relationships. Now we're in the phase where we are going to consult with them officially in the corridor, but we're also developing how this project is going to create socioeconomic benefits to Indigenous communities. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we have a commitment to try and meet a target of 5% employment of Indigenous people, 5% procurement. So that requires an important system to be put in place. We're working on this, and we've also said that we would like to discuss with indigenous communities how they could maybe become financial partners if they're interested in the project as well. So this is something very important to us.
So you have a team of people working on that?
Yeah, we have a team of almost 20 people dedicated to indigenous relations. We have also a team of about 10 people working on Ontario public and government relations, so dealing with municipalities, the provincial government, all kinds of associations. Same structure in Quebec as well.
Okay. The other question that keeps coming up from some of the folks that have been asking me a little bit about it is why these cities were picked. And because I've learned today already a little bit from you already, so that's a question that's coming from them.
Yeah. I'm afraid I don't have a precise answer for this. I think there's probably a bit of history, but it really is a decision that the Government of Canada made when they created the Crown Corporation that would take on the development of the Rapid Train project before it was confirmed that we would be named Alto, that it would be a high-speed rail project. Mm-hmm. The decision to serve those seven cities was made.
Okay. We'll let the folks, they can find out on the website, too.
As well,
right?
Yeah.
Yeah. The question that has come up as well is that you're only looking at one track for this high speed, or are there two tracks?
It's going to be two tracks. It's going to be two tracks. Okay. Fully electrified, mm-hmm, with a catenary system, because we're going to reach speeds that go around 300, 320 kilometers an hour. It's an infrastructure that needs to be fully secured so that it'll be fenced, and there's not going to be any grade crossings possible. So that's why we're going to have to build a whole lot of grade separations, whether it's overpasses or underpasses, to ensure the passage of vehicles.
And so that doing that, is it going to be completely fenced off so that wildlife or farmers be crossing it, or
that's
people
part
are
of
cottagers?
No, but that's part of what we need also to establish with the impact assessment agencies, how we're going to mitigate the impact of the infrastructure on animal movements. So there are ways to allow for, some passages or some mitigation measures. These are things that we're going to have to document and implement. As for the farmers, the impact on farmers, it really is key in our determination for the alignment. One element we want to do is to minimize the number of properties that we are going to cross. Mm-hmm. And if we have to acquire that 60-meter width of right-of-way on a farm property, we want to try as much as possible to be adjacent and parallel to property lines so that we don't cut in between. Mm-hmm. It's probably not going to be possible to avoid it 100%. But it's really the job of optimization that our team has to do. Like, we're at very high level now with a wide corridor. We're going to go down to a much narrower, and then in the end, we're going to have people looking, how we optimize this thing to make sure that it goes where it has to be.
That's going to be a challenge.
Well, that's why it takes time, yeah. And that's why it's important to get people's feedback early.
Will your team be going out to look at on the ground to see once you get closer to the 60?
Yes,
meters?
We have done at least two rounds of field studies in past years to start document the presence of endangered species, the pattern of migratory birds, presence of bats and other animals on the ground. So that environmental work is going to happen again this year. So we're going to soon announce a new round of field studies, and there's going to be information about it on our website. You can see information about past campaigns on our website currently, but we're going to explain what we're going to do next year. And this will give a very concrete feel to the project as well.
And will there be an opportunity for people to have input on specifics that you're going to look at when you go out on... when you get closer to where you're going to do this, for patterns of wildlife?
Well, obviously, any organization that has database, that has information, that's always useful to us. But we need, as a project proponent, to do our own work. We can't rely only on external sources, so that's why we're going to have teams on the ground to do our own
so
surveys.
So they're going to go out and do it in the field?
We have guidelines to respect that the Impact Assessment Agency is, has established.
In Ontario, there is the Ministry of Natural Resources, and I know years ago in the area that we're sitting in right now, Inverary and up to Charbot Lake, so it bridges over the two corridor pieces that you have here that you're looking at. They did some work on elk and elk herds in this area. That would be, if they're still here, the elk, then,
those are all things that we'll need to document. Yeah, definitely.
Right. Okay. So would it require someone in the community to say, oh, we've been looking at this, or is that something your team will...
No, this is something that our team has responsibility to do, and they have also the obligation to connect with authorities and know where these potential locations are and then go study there so that we can document.
So if some of our listeners hear what you've said here today and they live in one of these spots, but they may be an avid birder or someone who is out a hunter or communities where in the north, this larger corridor here, some of the people get their source of food from hunting. So would they have to go on and look for it, or would they...
No, but I think if people have information that is useful to us, they should send it our way. But obviously, we have an obligation to put our professionals on the ground and do our monitoring ourselves and then document it and file it part of our project definition and impact assessment.
I know some students that are looking for summer jobs.
Well, that's one thing I was going to say. We're going to need a lot of people to help this project to become a reality, whether it's land surveyors, land appraisers, biologists, summer jobs, skilled labor. So the project will create and maintain 50,000 jobs during construction. So it's a massive work.
And how many years to construct the whole thing?
Well, it's the development phase will last until the end of 2029. Then we have announced that the first segment to be developed is the one between Montreal and Ottawa, which is the smallest one, and it's between two provinces. So we will mobilize our teams in both provinces. And that would take about maybe 7 to 8 years to build. We're not going to wait until it's totally completed before we start working on the others. So it's going to be staggered. So, rough estimate, don't judge me on this 20 years down the road, but I would think that, for 15 years, the entire network could be pretty advanced.
So the logistics that's involved here is going to be extensive. You're going to have a huge team working on logistics.
Yeah, and they rotate. So you work on a specific aspect, then your team moves to another part of the network. So even within a segment, you've got smaller lots that are being developed, and it's a sign of a...
Right. So you learn from the first one, and as it spreads out, you get better.
Exactly.
I don't mean it in
well, the first way. The first ones are going to have good quality as well.
Yes, yeah. Yeah, I can tell you studied policy studies. Yeah, actually, there are a number of students at Queen's Policy Studies that are political science now. They've changed it from policy studies to political science.
I didn't know that.
Just
okay.
This year.
Really?
Yeah,
I kind of liked my master's. It was a great year. I was this young man from Quebec City, not speaking good English at all. And I believe I was one of the first, if not the first, Francophone to take on this program in 1998. And I can say it's a year that changed my life. So I'm very, very happy.
You might be invited to go to speak to the policy
studies. Who knows?
Studies
Who knows?
Because they still do their Friday afternoon.
Who knows? I remember those older men that came. I guess I'm one of them now.
I don't go with age, okay?
No, that's okay.
Anyway, this is quite interesting for me. And you're going to have to take a break from me right now because you need to go eat, I think.
But let's be in touch. If there's anything else, let us know. And then I'll leave you my coordinates.
Oh, okay. Thank you. And also, then I could talk to you about getting in touch with the other person if we need to.
Yeah. So I'll leave you my coordinates. But if you want, you know, other interviews, it would be probably better to contact our media services at media@altotrain.ca. Mm-hmm. But you know, if there are any connections with the Queens community, then you can send them my way.
Anything else you want to say before I turn this off?
Well, I think it's a project that now is creating, I guess, a lot of attention in the Kingston area for sure. But people also should consider the wider impact of this project. It's going to be one of those once-in-a-generation opportunities to change the way we move in Canada between our big cities, an opportunity also to have a long-lasting economic impact, a very important decision and infrastructure to help improve our climate performance. Obviously, this is going to move a lot of people off the road and offer a very interesting opportunity and different opportunity to travel. So really a project for the next generation, and I hope that it will attract a lot of attention mm-hmm. on campus.
Great. Thank you very much. I
appreciate
pleasure.
This.
Yeah. Good. Thank you.
Thank you for coming.
Thank you for taking me in.
Of course. Thanks for coming.
And thanks for your jacket.
The porch light on just in case. Open that door swings and I see your face. And I, how will I even run?
And I keep your photograph to this day, wishing and hoping that you're okay. And I'm missing you now.
Un erron a pitaron nairave. Kitsaron a tilitao laurave. Zernaron a anetaconerave. Taron a
was the same. Love remains. All this hurts inside me. Call your name to this day. Wish you were home beside me.
We've left your bedroom in its place. Posters and memories unerased. And I, oh,
I hold back my tears. Seems just like yesterday, although it's been years. And I'm missing you now.
Anero na pitachon nai rave. Kitzachon na tilitao lao rave. Zeon na chonga anetao kone rave.
Was the same, love remains. All this hurts inside me. Call your name to this day. Wish you were home beside me.
On just in case, open that door swings and I see your face. And I, how will I even run? I leave the porch light on just in case, Open that door, swings, and I see your face. And I'll lie you now.
Bob Gieschuk-Rice, thank you for being part of Aboriginal Voices today.
Thank you for having me, Douglas. I'm very honored to be here.
And I was just saying to you that we're sitting here in the sunshine right on the edge of Lake Ontario, the edge of the Cataraqui River, and the beginning of the St. Lawrence River.
Mm-hmm.
And so this actually brings to mind the travels that we are both on. You're traveling from Thunder Bay to Kingston to be part of the Kingston Writers Festival.
Mm-hmm.
And my voyage is going to be in the opposite direction next week. we're headed north towards Wasoxing, your community. We may end up there. I'm not sure.
Oh, neat. Right on.
So, we're both going to be traveling, but...
Always on the road, yeah.
But I wanted to talk to you about storytelling.
Uh-huh.
And doing some of the research in your work as a writer and an author, and you've got how many books now? Four? Five?
We've got three works of fiction and a couple of nonfiction, yeah. So, yeah, five altogether.
Okay. Over the past number of years, we won't tell anybody how old you are, but over the past number of years, you've been working as an author, as well as you do television and radio, and you're host now of Up North.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it's really up north, though.
It is, yeah. It's the afternoon show on CBC Radio for Northern Ontario, so basically covers from the French River all the way to the Manitoba border and up to James Bay Coast.
So you can't drive anymore or walk?
No.
Until it freezes over.
Not a whole lot of a same-day turnaround on stories covering that region, that's for sure.
So you're also a storyteller in another way. You use digital storytelling.
Mm.
And that's what struck me when I was reading. I wouldn't call it your blog, although people have called something like what you do a blog. But you do some writing, and it's not everyday writing.
Mm.
It's thoughtful writing about issues that hit you, family matters, or family, important people in your family, and that sort of thing. But I suspect the most important one to you right now is your son.
Yeah.
So tell me a little bit about doing digital writing.
I think it's more or less a way to harness modern techniques or modern tools for storytelling, really. When I was younger, I'd keep a diary or, just write random thoughts in notebooks here and there, and only I would see them, right? But I think with social media and with online media becoming so prevalent nowadays, young people especially have the opportunity to share their experiences and their ideas and their feelings to wider audiences. And I think when you're able to do that, you can really connect with a lot more people and then in turn help hone your own storytelling skills, right? So for me, maintaining a blog, that's not something I do as frequently as I'd like to. I only have enough time to post something every couple months. Should be a lot more frequent than that, but that's outside of the everyday work that I do as a journalist, because there's just no space to talk about your personal experiences. Even now as a radio host, not a whole lot, right? I'm not going to devote a whole 5-minute segment to what I had for lunch or, my opinions on, fried bread or anything like that, right? But having my own digital space allows me to sort of peel back the curtain a bit to my own life and not get too personal, but personal enough to really resonate with others and to sort of show them that some of the things I experience are relevant or relatable to them. And it's all easy and free to do nowadays. So I always try to recommend young people to harness these technologies, harness, their phone technology even to do that, right? To speak their truths and share their experiences. Because I think it's really worthwhile. And right now, as young Indigenous people especially have the opportunity to have a wider network in that sense. So it can go a long way to helping or maintaining different ways of life, I guess you could say. Eh?
So, speaking about young people, we're talking young people being sort of 12 to 20 that range. But no, that's the group I'm thinking of right now. And there's a lot of concern about digital writing.
Mm-hmm.
So you put it out there for anybody to see.
And do you worry about some of the things that you write when you're doing it this way, or do you put your feelings out the way you've talked about it?
Yeah, I am a little reserved about some things. There are some things I won't share outright. And if I'm writing about something that impacts my family, I'll make sure that I run it by family members that I may impact, right? Like whether it's, you know, the death of a relative or other traumatic or tragic experiences. Mm-hmm. The idea behind sharing things like that is to not only help myself heal, but to help others heal as well, right? And that's something I've tried to focus on in my fiction writing as well. But yeah, you know, you do have to be cautious. But being a good writer or learning how to do it effectively is about making yourself vulnerable and being candid and being as honest as possible, not only to yourself, but to the people who are going to be reading what you've written. So yeah, there is some caution that goes into that. But I think you have to take those risks and be comfortable with opening yourself up. And I think that helps you as a storyteller, but more importantly, helps a reader connect with you.
And also, you said that these are free tools. So,
yeah.
You know, some people worry that if they do a blog or go onto a website that they have to worry about paying for something.
Mm-hmm.
Like that. So how do young people know that a safe place to go to?
That's a good question. I think it probably starts with social media and being comfortable with sharing on those platforms like Facebook or Twitter. And that really sort of opens the door to broadcasting on such a wide scale, you know? Mm-hmm. So I think it starts there. Those are free platforms. And then once people get, and I've seen this progression, once people get the hang of sharing, like, you know, meaningful and fully formed posts about whatever they're going through in their lives, then they start pursuing other blog options like Tumblr or WordPress or things like that, right? Mm-hmm. So I think it starts there. It starts with just trying it out in these smaller chunks on social media and then seeing where that leads you, essentially.
Yeah, I think you just were talking there to the teachers who were teaching writing in the schools.
Yeah.
Because, yeah, you get people started, write a paragraph, write a little bit,
yeah,
make them connected, and
exactly,
away you go.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Okay, so it's the same process, it's just a different platform.
Yeah, I'd say so. And, you know, like, I'm not a young person anymore, so I don't know.
You're still young to us.
Well, thanks. Yeah, so I can't put myself in the headspace of a youth nowadays, so I don't know what it's like to look at these tools and these methods of storytelling and feeling whether they're viable or not. But I'm seeing people use them, mm-hmm, effectively, so, you know, it's helping some people develop these skills anyway.
I like the term that you used about storytelling, and so it would be more along the line of getting people comfortable telling stories, and
yeah,
they don't have to be their personal events or issues that someone would be talking about, but they don't have to have all of the personal,
yeah,
nitty-gritty things. They just bring out a story and tell it.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that you won an award, a special award from, and you mentioned it a while ago,
mm-hmm,
that 40 groups of, who are the 40 people?
Oh, it's, it's the Anishinaabeg Nation. It's the political organization that represents 40 Anishinaabeg communities in Ontario. So yeah, I received their Debwaywin citation in 2014, and that's for recognition in storytelling. And yeah, I got that mostly for my general work over the years as both a journalist and as an author. But I think what I'm especially proud of is the acknowledgement of my advocacy for Anishinaabe experiences or stories, right? Because that's at the core of what I do, is I want to help people share their experiences and share their truths to wider audiences.
Mm-hmm.
So working as a journalist, it's the greatest honor to have someone share their story with me to relay it to everybody else and to trust me with that, you know? So if that's what I'm being recognized for with an honor like that, then I feel like I've accomplished what I've always set out to do.
That is good advice for a lot of young people listening right now, because they'll be in the same stance that you're in now mm-hmm. in a few years because
mm-hmm.
yeah, you're still young.
Well, thank you.
So I'm just thinking about the last part of this would be when we looking at digital, you don't put pictures in about the people or the events, you just write. So is that the best way to go with storytelling?
I wouldn't necessarily say so. I think pictures are effective. It depends, you know, as I mentioned earlier, I'd get someone's consent before using right. their image, right?
Yeah.
But in a digital world, I think people gravitate toward more and more towards imagery nowadays because it's so much more accessible.
Mm.
So I think it's an effective way to help maybe carry your words along. But that's not to say it's necessary. I think if you just want to speak your truth with just words, then by all means, try that, because I think that would be, it just helps you hone your skill, right? You know, but from a journalistic perspective, I think that's where my feelings on images come from, is that they are essential to some stories, but not necessarily, right? So, yeah, I guess I could go back and forth on that, to tell you the truth.
I haven't asked, are you an artist too, or?
An art, like a visual artist?
Yes.
No.
So you're a wordsmith.
Yeah, I to some degree, I guess.
Well,
Geshik Rice, I appreciate you taking the time today and sharing with our listeners here in Aboriginal Voices. And I'm going to leave the last word to you. Encouragement for anyone who's going to get started writing.
I would say just write. Be truthful to yourself. Don't be afraid to be vulnerable. Put yourself out there. Share your experience and your writing with others. But also, write what you want to read. Put yourself in the stories that you want to see out there. And I think that is the most powerful thing you can do for yourself and for your community. Because for far too long, Indigenous voices have been ignored or neglected in this country. And now I think there's a greater spotlight on Indigenous experiences through the mainstream media. And because of that, there's more of a potential for people to speak their truths and share their experiences because they're valid. My message to young people is, no matter who you are, your experience in your life is valid. And if you want to share that, you deserve to have your story heard and read. So keep telling it.
Wapgishik Rice, Chimigwech.
Chimigwech, Douglas.
He who controls the spice controls the universe.
When the clock strikes midnight, the night truly begins. Step into the darkness on CFRC's Retro Radio Show, diving deep into the sounds of the past, from haunting classics to underground gems. This is DJ Terry, and every Friday night at midnight till 2 a.m., tune your dial to 101.9 or CFRC.ca and let the music pull you in.
You're listening to CFRC 101.9 FM, your campus community radio station, broadcasting to you since 1922.
Hi, everyone. Welcome back to Revolving Door on CFRC 101.